listening to excellent radio. And in a moment, we'll be taking care of the spoken word program for Margaret Lang. Norm Hammond and I will be sitting around chatting about all kinds of things that have happened here on the Central Coast that you may not know about. And even if you do know about them, you're going to learn something else, too. Stick around. We'll be breaking out of the jazz mode in a little bit here. Later on tonight, if the creek don't rise any higher, Frankly Frank will be in with his extremely hardcore heavy metal, punk metal show. That'll take care of the rain on your roof. Quite a flood out there. Be careful when your brakes get wet. You don't stop as fast as you used to. We're noticing that on a regular basis. So if you're in La La Land as you're driving down Grand Avenue, take this little tip and slow down right now. Tomorrow night on Pollution Solution, I believe we're going to have a very interesting show for you. A man named, I don't remember his last name, Scott, will be coming by with toys that he introduces to the schools as cooperative toys instead of competitive toys, things that bring out the best in us. So tune in and find out what the heck I'm talking about tomorrow on our Pollution Solution show. Let's see. I'm going to get our microphones going here. I'm going to bring Jazz down and the Abel Steinberg Winant Trio and music of Henry Cowell up underneath us here. Never skip a beat. That's us. Hey, Norm.
How you doing, Charlie?
We're listening to some Henry Cowell, and there are other excerpts of from this music that kind of underlie our discussion for a while here.
Sounds like a good thing to do on a rainy night like this.
I got a couple extra logs. I'm throwing them on the fire right now, if you follow my drift.
Here I go. I'm getting my feet up.
This is something we're going to have to keep an eye on. I just noticed that those raindrops are about as big as my hand right now, and this particular area of Grand Avenue oftentimes turns into a little tidal wave. Looks like a bad Japanese B-grade movie here when the water comes backwards and floods the studio. Alan Olson remembers that particular time. He was in about 2 inches of water broadcasting. So we're going to keep an eye on that and let that be part of the ambiance tonight. And I was telling folks that we would be talking about the Central Coast and the flavor of what it's been like to live here on the Central Coast. And you know quite a bit about folks who've lived here.
Well, I know a little bit about a few of the people that lived here, but certainly not all of them.
Well, there's a group of them. Actually, I guess we'd probably be talking about two of the main groups that have crossed our bow, and that would be, of course, the Dunites, but there's also another more modern-day expression going on by another group of people that are focused on the experiences they had out at a place called Paradise Cove out here near Point Sol. And you know quite a bit about that. In fact, you were instrumental in keeping the spirit of what that place was alive.
I kind of found myself as being a scribe of sorts. There was a lot of people going down there, and there was a ramshackle cabin built there hanging out over the ocean on a cliff, and not real accessible or easy to get to. And so I would go down there and spend the night. Sometimes I'd spend up as many as five nights, and The place was really unbelievable. And every time I went down there, I could see that somebody had been there and left different things lying around. And so I kind of wondered what those people were doing. And so what I wound up doing is just putting together a kind of a logbook for people to write in. And so in time, a lot of people were writing in this book, and none of us knew each other, but we communicated back and forth thoughts and feelings and impressions through the book.
I spent many times out there, only one night, actually, but it was full of events. There was more than enough stuff to talk about or remember. Try to describe the area out there. It's so isolated with almost a magical path that you have to go through to get there from wherever you might start, even if it's out on at the top of the mountains on Brown Road, if you start that way, or if you park at the Guadalupe beach and trek across.
It's not easy to get to, and I think that was part of the charm of the place to me, because I never saw anybody down there. I always went in during the week, and I could see that there would be a few visitors maybe to the weekend, but basically a lot of people were intimidated by just getting in there. So it was isolated. Not too many people found their way that far down the beach.
This is out near what people know as Devil's Slide. And in the early days, when I first got here, which was like December of 72, it was a pretty wild story. Anybody who got that far out was really a pioneer or into the big sand races story. And my going out there was just kind of a fluke, absolute fluke. And I crawled to the top of that Devil Slide and then could see beyond what people here on the Central Coast might be able to see, that there was another whole strand of beach out around this kind of, what would that point be, the first point that you cross in regards to just before you get to the waterfall and all that. Is there a name for that?
People call it Muscle Rock. A lot of people mistakenly think that's Point Sal itself, but it isn't. You can't see Point Sal proper from here in San Luis Obispo County. But so the first point is Muscle Rock, and then when that high point that you climb to the top of is actually about 500 feet high in loose sand, so that does turn a lot of people around before they get that far. But like you say, from the top up there, you can see Point Sal proper and the beach that lies between Muscle Rock and Point Sal.
You end up having to either go down real steep hills into this ravine that also has a second waterfall a little further back, excuse me, or you have to wind yourself around the edge of the sand dunes that go along the edge of the ocean, and footpaths were often whittled out of that, people that would become adventurous, or maybe it was cows, I don't know. That was the other thing that you would often encounter. And anyways, many of those things kept you from finally getting down onto that other beach and the beginning of visiting many different ecosystems that would change within, you know, 20 or 30 feet.
That lower trail you're talking about is extremely hazardous, and I don't think it's even passable today. The first few times I went across there, I was purposely thinking light because, like you say, those footsteps were carved in the sand that were kind of semi-solidified with salt air. And but immediately below you was about a 20-foot drop right into the ocean, so that always made me nervous. And when I went down with a pack, I would sometimes have 35 or 40 pounds on my back for an extended stay. And I decided, after going across there one time, that was the last time. I would go the hard way up, straight up the 500-foot dune and over the top to get out.
Yeah, I I can still remember some of those, wondering how wise I was crawling along. But we all did it, and we did it with inexperienced people with flip-flops on or something like that. And I don't know, I guess something must have been watching over those that made it around the corner. I never heard of anybody really hurting themselves out there.
Not to my knowledge. I don't think anybody's got hurt there, but I just kind of, after my last trip across there, I made the decision not to do it anymore because it was just too unsafe. It's a lot harder to go up over the top, but since that day, I've always gone up, and it's three steps up and two steps back in that steep sand, but just take your time.
Yeah, zigzag across. It's certainly easy enough to go down, though.
That's the fun part. That's the fun part.
Those steep walls out there are just so much fun. When we would hike down from taking Brown Road to the top of Point Sol, we would go through like Happy Valley and those other old ranches that had fallen apart, those eucalyptus areas. By the time we'd finally get over there to Muscle Rock and all of that, we were pretty tired of our slow movement. And you could run down the sides of these maybe greater than 500 feet hills in these pockets of sand and not hurt yourself. You would just zigzag down along the mountain and feel like your the sand in your shoes, of course, were about maybe 50 or 60 pounds, and that would propel you down this thing as if you had wings. Then down at the bottom of it, you just sort of lay there for a while and your head would expand, and well, that's a whole nother story.
On the way in there one time, I saw some kids, and they had invented a game for going down those steep slopes. It wasn't right at the cabin, but it was further on up the beach in an area that's easier to get to, and one would grab one's ankles and the other one would grab the other ankles. And they would throw their torsos outward to make a wheel, and they would roll in a human wheel down these huge dunes.
Geez, what was in the water out there? I don't know. We spent a day out there at the cabin and just letting the place entertain us. And even with, I think, God, we must have had 15 kids there with us. It was still a lot of fun. There were so many different places to go and feel you were making your own personal communion with wherever you were. There was a lot of that spirit communication going on out there.
That was the part that I enjoyed, was reading the impressions of the other people. I remember on one trip down there, I'd always wait until sundown. And after supper was over, then I would take the logbook and look and see who had written in the book. And in that way, I was never really totally alone. But I do remember when I came across the entry where you had been down there and your son Mercury also. And it was kind of neat because most of the people down there that showed up, I didn't know them. You were one of the few people who I knew personally who came there and spent time and made entries in the logbook.
That's nice to hear that we made it into the book, because the other night you told me that there's a website of this, and I'm so glad that other people are getting to understand the Central Coast for the right reasons. And I was so afraid that, you know, much of the Dunite history and the history of that particular cabin and what it meant might be lost, but now people are still alive and I guess continuing to talk about what their experiences were, and that's kind of what we're doing here now. And I'm sure there's others who we could give a ring to and would jump onto this particular show. We could pipe them in over the top and you'd hear just another volume.
Well, that's kind of what we're trying to do with the website is, the people out there were not connected in any way except through the book, and hopefully they'll become aware of what's happening there and be able to kind of tie in and see the stuff that they put in there. There's some absolutely fantastic artwork that different people did. while they were there. And of course, the cabin is gone now, but the area is still a fantastic place to visit. And we're hoping that more people who visit the area will be able to add to the existing material from that time that the cabin was there, so that it'll be kind of a continuing, ongoing thing.
For a long time, I got the impression that they didn't know who you were.
I always use my initials, and everybody in time came to do the same thing, because as people, it didn't matter who we really were. It was that we kind of had a common purpose, and that was to go to that wild and remote place and just be alone and kind of tune in to what was there, the natural beauty and nature and the specialness of that special place.
Jim, what were the years of that particular cabin? I know a lot of folks camped out there, but I think the cabin was a focal point. How long did that last?
The cabin was built in 82, and I had been there for a couple of years before I discovered it. A lady friend of mine, Kathleen Jones, who many of you, your readers or your listeners will know, had been across there and saw it, and she called me and said, "Did you know there's a cabin down there?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And this was in 1984, and so the first time I got a chance to get away, I went down there, and I visited the cabin for the next 7 years up until 1992, when it was destroyed. So we're looking at, I think, about a 11-year period when the cabin was there.
And it was quite a piece of architecture. It was certainly no square cabin. It was built right on the edge and kind of in the form of the bow of a boat, it seemed. When you got inside, it was very different. It didn't make any sense at all.
My first impression was that some architecture student had done that as a project and deliberately did not have any parallel lines in the whole building. None of the sides of the cabin were parallel, and none of the horizontal or the vertical support beams were parallel. It had a very ramshackle look to it, and it vaguely resembled a ship in that the front part was sharp and pointed out into the ocean. And so it did, in a way, resemble a ship a little bit. But I later found out that it wasn't an architecture student. It was just a fellow who had been going there for years and years. And during the storms in the early 80s, a lot of timbers washed up on the beach. They were 2x4 timbers, and nobody knows exactly where they came from, but they, on the ends, there was remaining traces of some kind of dark, very dark red paint. So it must have been some building up the coast somewhere that had come apart during a storm and washed down and wound up on the beach. Well, the person who built the cabin kind of prefers to remain anonymous, just because he's a private person. But he went down with a saw and a bag of nails and a hammer and spent about a week putting this thing together. And it was a beautiful piece of work. It fit perfectly with the environment.
And over the years, the grains in the wood became very prominent. And that created a feeling with anybody who was inside as if, you know, they were part of the fabric.
There was an interesting view window on the front out over the ocean. And, of course, there was no glass there, so it was kind of a plank window, if you will, that you could raise up and put a stick under it. And you had this fantastic view that you could look out over the ocean, watch the sunset.
There were some inhabitants out there that you participated with, the pack rats.
Somebody named a pack rat. The main character out there was called Molly, and the biggest rat I think I've ever seen in my life. And at night, you kind of depend on being awake a while trying to go to sleep because she made the rounds, tried to get into everything, and it would be several hours after the light went out that things would quiet down.
Yeah, it was pretty scary for those kids. I'll tell you, that thing was huge. And I think maybe there were so many that she was reluctant to join us that particular night. But eventually we lost some food.
The only thing I lost down there, I'm in a habit of taking notes and stuff when I was down there, and had my spiral pad and my pen lying out. And in the morning, and I knew exactly where that stuff was. It was in the frying pan. And there's a big cast iron skillet, and it's just a handy place to put that stuff when I went to sleep. And I heard the racket in the night, and then when I woke up in the morning, the spiral pad was there, the pen was gone, and in its place was a rusty tin can lid. So they like to trade. I don't know what kind of psychology they have, but they'll oftentimes bring something from their little stash and leave it in place of the thing they take. Strange behavior.
Well, and those are the kind of things that put you into communicating with the spirit natures so quickly out there.
It was interesting because, you know, when you're in a place like that, it's kind of a sensory deprivation thing. You know, we're bombarded with stimuli here, you know, in the cities and the towns, and everything is designed to get your attention and make you buy something and that sort of thing. But down there was nothing at all. And after a day or two, you kind of got in tune with it, and you found yourself taking a great deal of amusement with these things, some of the creatures. The bats would come out at night, and that you could see them fighting the onshore breeze, and it'd hook around behind the cabin where the wind didn't blow, and just kind of dart around back there, eating the bugs. It would little clouds of gnats, and they would kind of dive in there and scatter the gnats out, and then they would go back out into the wind around the front of the cabin, and you could see they were having a little trouble in that wind, and they would hang out there until the gnats regrouped, and then back they would come, and it actually got to be kind of entertaining after a while.
There was definitely some pacing out there. We noticed, or I certainly noticed over the many years, that there were some definite weather themes that would happen throughout the day, from the very early morning and the rising of the fog and the warming of the beach and the lifting of the fog and offshore fog that you could visibly swim out and touch that didn't come onto the land, and then later in the afternoon the cooling off of the weather and breezes starting up.
Yeah, it was always fun watching the changing of the weather there. Occasionally we had extremely hot days with offshore winds that stayed long enough to bring you the scent of the sage that was up on top. Up on top of that 500-foot bluff is rolling sand dunes with a lot of this California sage. And when the weather is really hot, that stuff has a real sweet, pungent smell. So what would happen is that wind would kind of shift back and forth and alternate, and what you would get is the classic traditional sea breeze, and it would be punctuated by these bursts of scent of this California sage that was so sweet smelling, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, beginning of indigenous aromatherapy.
Why not?
There were also streams that came down kind of out of nowhere as you walked along that beach and created little ecosystems, miniature worlds. You almost felt like you were standing up above our globe in space sometimes, and magnificent succulents and calla lilies and water bugs and frogs. It was just an amazing display, kind of like Mother Nature shook her blanket and all of these things kind of popped out of it.
I used to call that the hanging gardens. You know, they talk about the wonders of the old ancient world where they had the hanging gardens of Babylon. And about an eighth of a mile south of the cabin were what I call the dripping springs, and that's where I used to go fill my pots. And out hanging off those rock cliffs were these festoons of watercress, which was just delicious and really quite a sight. All this watercress just kind of hanging in curtains with the water dripping off, and I used to love to sit there and just put my pots underneath there and get a little music for a while they ding, 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 and fill themselves up, and think to myself, what a place. And down there by myself, you know, stay as long as I want, no rent, no taxes. It was not a bad setup.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I just spaced out thinking about just that. The heat and walking around barefoot and just turning off the rest of the world and letting the vibrations and the undercurrent of pretty heavy ocean out there. That was a deep bowl there, and the thickness of the vibration coming up through it toned you. It was much different than, let's say, here where the rumble of the cars creates some kind of staccato. Out there, it's like a deep, constant roar.
Sometimes when the wind was offshore, there was a strange condition created there where the waves would come in, and I guess the surfers look for this kind of thing where the waves will stand longer than they normally do because the wind holds the face of the wave up, and you'd hear this prolonged hissing noise. As it's all sucking back and the wave keeps standing and standing and standing. And this would happen late at night when you're asleep, and all of a sudden there'd be this boom that would actually shake the cabin. That didn't happen all the time, but boy, it would startle you and bring you out of a sound sleep, I'll tell you.
Another thing I noticed, there were some points there when you came around that Muscle Rock where you're actually out in the ocean, and that pastel rainbow effect would happen, and you'd swear that it was as thick as a brick. The spray would be coming off, the sun would be reflecting probably in front of it, down off the ocean, and back up through the spray.
Yeah, that spindrift is what they call it, and if the sun is at the right angle, and I don't know exactly what that is, it's the same angle of refraction that causes a phenomenon known as sun dogs, where you'll in the sky you'll see if the clouds are just right, it looks like two suns, and one is I think about 30 degrees apart from the other. I don't know what that is, but when that occurs with the sun at the right angle with the wind pulling the tops of those waves back and throwing it back like you're talking about, you talk about a rainbow effect. I mean, I don't think you can photograph it, but boy, you sure can't miss seeing it.
Yeah, it's in there forever. I was going to ask you about your photographs at your website, at Bill Buck's website. Those are pretty clear. They're really, you know, almost vibrant 3D.
I think it's just the subject matter itself. I think you could take a little Polaroid camera down there and get some pretty spectacular shots. So I can't take any credit for being a good photographer.
I do notice there's a lot of clouds out there, and the dynamics of those clouds lend you to this surreal feeling.
Well, you know, the place is kind of a surreal place to begin with. That was a lot of the attraction for me and for other people, because you're kind of down in a bowl there. You've got this big cliff behind you and these huge, massive headlands to the north and the south of you, and then this beautiful beach with not a soul on it, and, of course, this the huge ocean stretching out. And, you know, you're at once alone, but you're very much surrounded in this almost like a pocket at that place. So And it's overpowering. The feeling is overpowering. And I kind of started seeing the same patterns in the writings of people who went there, had that same feeling, and they were just overwhelmed by it. And I don't care where you live. You know, everybody thinks they live at the center of the universe, and I'm sure that people in Elm Creek, Nebraska, have the same conviction. And there is no doubt, you know, some kind of probably epicenters or power places everywhere. But for myself, you know, I could really tune into it there and didn't have to use my imagination at all. It was just, I could feel it. And so could other people.
There is a history, a recognition by other civilizations to the power of this area.
I think so. You know, the way this website came about, I got a phone call from this fellow, Bill Buck, and I recognized the name from the logbook. He did a lot of artwork while he was down there, and he did a lot of writing. And I said, yeah, I remember you because you used to write in the book. And he said, well, I'm in town. I'd like to come by and see you. And I says, well, sure, fine. So he came over, and he came up. He had the idea of putting together the website. And I said, well, gosh, why not? I think it's a great idea. So we've kind of gone back and forth, and I send him photographs on CD and documents and manuscripts and just kind of about everything I have to throw on this website. And he's scrambling to get it all down and have it make sense. And, of course, other people are starting to tune in now and get on board. And I don't know that much about what websites do, but we're getting a response. And so I have to give him credit for being innovative in getting out there and reproducing this information in this electronic form. It's pretty exciting. He came down a couple of weeks ago and wanted to go back to the cabin area, and I kind of haven't been going down there too much because it was kind of a traumatic thing for me when the cabin was gone, and I kind of went through some withdrawals or something because I don't really have a replacement for that, you know, as kind of a one-shot thing in my life. And but we went down there, and I had a bottle of wine that I kept down there that was I etched with a sandblasting outfit with the symbol of the winged eye, and that was a symbol that was predominantly used in the cabin. There's a lot of different versions of it, and I really don't know where it came from. But anyhow, so he wanted to find the bottle, and so we went down, and I went right to where it was, and he was pretty excited about that. So
wow.
He was pretty stoked.
Yeah, I'm glad that it's happened. You know, we have had the Dunite shows here, and are accumulating all the information of the things that have happened through here in that regards. But, gosh, we're kicking ourselves all the time that it ain't out there, and it feels so good to know that at least some semblance of it that we are going to meet has already started, and on the right note, too.
You know, I think it's important that we who live in a place like this or anywhere really record what happens for other people so that down the road they can kind of see what people did in the place they live and what they thought and what they felt and what they were generally all about. And that's kind of been a thing I've done. I've been curious in about, you know, the people who were here before me, and that's I've spent a great deal of time trying to bring this information to light. And I kind of, when I was down at Point Sal, became aware that the same kind of thing is going on here in Point Sal and going on everywhere, really. And it's somebody should put that down, because down the road, somebody's going to want to know just what was going on. It's like I was telling you earlier here at the Hole in the Sky. You know, there's been so much stuff happening here, and time goes by and people forget, you know, that you've had poetry readings here and art shows, and now you're having live theater and music and the radio. I remember when you first got the radio station up and going, and there's always something happening here. It's really kind of a vibratory thing in the South County, and people drive by, and maybe it's not big time and it's not, you know, prime time even, but there's always something going on, and it's important that people know what's going on around them and what's gone on in the past, and that's just kind of how I feel about life.
Yeah, and now the need quickens, as they say, as we look at all of our culture is quickly being forgotten. And, you know, what do we connect to? What, so many people have forgotten their abilities, their creative abilities, and that heritage. Yeah, it's sad how quickly things are disappearing. But now, finally, maybe the answer to that is the availability of websites like that make it easier for a small group like us to craft our message so that the right impression happens and that we don't have to depend on, you know, possibly getting a book published at much expense to yourself and who's going to distribute it and all the other headaches. Instead, maybe the energy can be put right directly towards getting the artist's feeling or the area's feeling directly into other people so that we don't cloud it.
I think that's a very important point, Charlie. You know, people, technology changes so much, and it used to be, you know, you had a spiral pad and a pen, and you write it down, and maybe somewhere down the road somebody would type it, and then maybe somewhere down the road, if you were popular enough, maybe somebody would publish it, and there'd be a coffee table book with your name on it. And really, that's nice, but it's not that important. The important thing is to get it out there. And in retrospect, maybe that's pretty archaic and pretty Stone Age when you can flip a switch and electronically have all this stuff come up in brilliant colors and photographs and drawings, and we're just touching the surface of it. And maybe someday people will look back on all the stuff we have here and it'll be very crude and very primitive, but yet, you know, it'll be interesting.
And will also contain that element of truth that we're all looking for. I think that's probably one of the most important things.
Yes, it is. Well, ultimately, you know, that's what everybody's striving for. They want to see what's going on. And, you know, the world is kind of a big wheel spin trip anyhow, and everybody's trying to get traction in however they can. And so, and that's what you said, it's truth. People want to know what it's about. What is the truth? What is life? What is what is the answer to these big important questions? And so I think it's important that whatever people think, it should be recorded and shared with other people.
Quite a turning point as we look at machinery. We're not sure how to run, and we know darn well that these things are going to become what we have to run our lives. And, you know, getting past the fear of it and recognizing that this is sort of like the church key to your creativity and that you're entitled to it, to me, heralds a renaissance of sorts that so many people could be awakened at, you know, so very quickly.
That's exactly right. It seems like everything is happening so fast, and there's so much, and we're all so unaware of what is there and how it can be accessed. And it's a little bit complicated, these machines you're talking about. Nobody knows how they work. They do wondrous and marvelous things. We just have to believe, and sure enough, it does happen. But again, the important part is to share awareness, you know, in our path, whatever we're trying to do.
Yeah. We haven't even covered anything about the Dunites, and it's too bad because I wanted to draw a parallel with the vast amount of creativity that happened during their time here. And in a sense, they're too soon, because the opportunities that we currently have, say, through micropower radio or the computer and other kind of digital things, has given us an opportunity to bring closure to the creativity that those people had and the desire that they had for this world.
A closure, yes, but also a continuum, because
it's the same
basic issues that people are concerned with: human rights and politics, economics, aesthetics. These are the same questions that have been beat around since day one. And the Dunites, a great many of them, that's what they were doing, was trying to get away from civilization as they knew it and pierce back down through their different layers of awareness and look for answers. Who am I? What am I doing here? What is my purpose? Is there anything to be gained? Whatever. And of course, that was a time period, and a fascinating time period, too, because it was right here on the Central Coast. It's in our own backyard. And the same thing is happening here. I've seen people here at the Hole in the Sky, different readings you've had, different art shows you had, and it's the same path that these people are on. So, you know, I drive by this place and I feel good about it. I stop in once in a while, and this won't be here forever. You know, I wish where I'm sitting right now I could kind of do a visual scan and record everything that's on these walls. I see you got the birds from the atomic, what is that?
That was from the Shadow Project.
That's it, Shadow Project. And you've had that many years here, every year. And the music and the art and some of your art that you've collected at garage sales is fantastic. you always have, you know, stuff you find and put on the wall for a while, and here's some artist, and nobody knows who the person is, you know, and it's thrown away practically in a garage sale. It's back on the wall. I'm sitting here looking.
Hey, you know about the art that, oh boy, have we got a strange story between us. The art that I found in the thrift shop that you used to own.
I don't know how that happened. It was a painting of chrysanthemums by Emily Dean, who was an artist in the Dunes, and I knew about her, and I knew about her work, and I've, you know, traced it down and photographed it, and I was in here one day, and that painting was on the wall. It somehow got away from me, and I says, I know that painting, Charlie. And
that was up at our house, if you remember.
That's right. I'm correct.
You were invited for dinner, and you didn't, when you saw it at first, you thought maybe I was pulling a joke on you.
Yeah, I thought it was a joke. I thought he'd get this, and he's waiting for me to say something, and he didn't.
I had no idea.
So I finally, and I was pretty sure, but I had to go back in my files and bring a photograph and compare it, and sure enough, it was that very painting. So there's some strange parallels that that go on here.
Somehow that got swept up in stuff that was given to a thrift shop, and maybe it didn't make it through a garage sale or something and got donated, and I had it for a very long time. I found some other things in this area. Ralph Holmes, who was, I guess, the first professional painter in Atascadero. His artwork graces the rotunda underneath the rotunda of the City Hall in Atascadero. And it's another one of those that have just sort of got swept up and was connected to a vibrant history that many people wouldn't even know happened here.
I remember back in the back room there, you had a machine that did shrink wrapping, and
still do.
During the Dune Spirit Festival, you had people working back there, shrink wrapping art and hanging it, and there was a piece of art on the wall that was abstract, done in very brilliant crayons, and I looked at that thing and I said, I like that thing, and I started. And finally I got around, where did you get that? And, of course, the same old story is somebody's cast away and has been resurrected and put on the wall. So it's kind of like this place is full of that stuff.
Oh, man, the back room. Whew. Murder story. I desire empty walls in my dreams.
Well, it's a good thing you don't do that in practice, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you said something about the abstract. Because, you know, having done the art of the Dunites, specifically Elwood Decker's art, And having that in the building here and having to spend a lot of time with it, and then later on having it exposed to me with 3D glasses, a small family came through here and saw the exhibit and decided to go home and build their own 3D glasses and come and see this. And they grabbed me out of the store next door and said, "You got to see this." And it was true. It was like you could step right into these paintings. Like if you've ever been in a kelp bed.
Yeah.
Elwood.
That was great. You know, you had a lot of his artwork. And of course, you knew him quite
yes.
well. He was your neighbor, I guess, for a long time. And he was a very good friend of mine, too. And I thought it was great that we could have his art hanging here. You know, he was never what you would call a successful artist, and he didn't mind that. He one time took a penny out of his pocket and he placed it on one of his drawings and drew a circle around it with a pencil, and then within that circle he drew some lines that collectively made up all the letters in his name. And he smiled at me and he says, "You know," he says, "this is the only way I ever let money interfere with my artwork." And of course, you know, money generally spells success in most people's value system. It never did with him. And he had a few exhibits when he lived in the Los Angeles area, and that was kind of about it. So I felt really good that, you know, we had an exhibit of his work right here at the Hole in the Sky, and it was very successful. You had a little visitor guest book there, and every time I'd come in, and I'd stop in a couple of times a week, a lot of names, a lot of people coming and going to see this stuff.
Yeah, there have been quite a few people that we've stayed in touch with. I remember it was Basil who came by. Does that ring a bell to you at all?
No, is he the fellow you were talking about?
Yeah.
No, I don't recognize his name at all.
Maybe somebody else spent more time with him, but knew a lot of the early history here. I just thought maybe that would have rung a bell. Yeah, so anyways, the abstract stuff that Elwood did really permeated me. As you said, I knew him for many years, and thanks to Gudrun Grell, I guess really the patron saint of the Excellent Center in a large way, the opportunity she'd given me for a place to live afforded me that extra margin to do the things that we've done here in a sense. And she was a kind of a caretaker for Elwood in his second visit to the Central Coast after a long exodus. And she provided him with another almost idyllic situation that would still keep him within proximity of the area that he loved. And people probably still remember him and his bright, colorful clothing and the vibrancy for a man his age as he went up and down Grand Avenue going about his day. So Elwood and I would kind of crisscross paths almost every day.
Yeah, you know, he had a nice place up there. That Gudrun provided for him, kind of at the top of a hill and in right in the center of an auto cava grove, and an excellent view of the dunes. And he was quite happy there.
Edge, and the other edge was the eucalyptus, and then down below him was the entire town of Halcyon. And it was a converted garage that she'd put together and then converted the other part into an apartment. And he still continued to pump out art. Every day he had something that he had produced.
You know, he was 88 years old when he died. And he worked on art until his very last day. Every day he worked. Of course, his focus, what he was trying to do, was give the message of love and God in his paintings, and always in his paintings you would find the message, and usually it was J Ma, which means victory to the universal mother. And on the backside, he would have something that was a little less subtle, perhaps, you know, a message on the backside.
The messages on the backsides of the artwork was a very big part of our exhibit here. And we can thank Trish, my wife, for bringing that out. It was a very unique way to understand the artist and his art and where he was aiming you at. And you always got the feeling like as serious as things are, there's always room for the break of a smile in almost everything he wrote. And it was really a pleasure to go back through his old correspondence that was, when he died, they cleared out his place, and there was so much insight, so much love going on in his letters to people I'm not sure who they even were. But he never changed through that whole time. I never got the feeling that he was had an angry period, or that his whole world fell apart and became cynical or something like most of us. He was who he was through that whole period that was exposed to us. And a lot of it was exposed because of, for instance, construction site came with a soundtrack and a slideshow. And that was one way to get involved with him. But there were also remnants of audio tapes that we salvaged that gave us an understanding of where he was going as far as religion. He was in an ashram in, believe it or not, Oklahoma.
Yeah, he was there for a number of years before he came back out here to the Central Coast. You know, you were saying, you know how he was continuously involved in his artwork, and he was dedicated as what he was. And I remember after he died, he didn't have any family, and somehow the state got a hold of me and asked if I would kind of help dispose of his effects, which I did. And I went over there, and you could see on his table his carvings and his paintings and everything left right there from the previous day. And so we went through the thing of boxing it all up for the most part. And I know you wound up with a lot of the audio stuff that I knew you were interested in, and a lot of his early photographic work, his abstract photography. I was mostly interested, you know, in his writing, because that's what I do. But I remember having the impression that he would get these flashes of insight and write stuff on whatever he found.
Yeah.
Gosh, up over the doorway, he had, it was an old ticket from a grocery store, and he'd written on that thing, "Life is my TV," and tacked it to the wall, just bang. And he had boxes of stuff that were laying around his work table, and I was going through that, and there was a brown paper sack, and I never will forget this, and on there was written, "Love is a white butterfly we have set free to lead us back to God." Wow. It blew me away, you know, and you could see where that thought had crossed his mind, and he had scribbled it down and shoved it aside and continued on in another path. It was just going in his head all the time, right up to the day he died.
I'm not remembering the entire inscription for the Dune Goddess. Can you still remember that? Bubbles of Dune Goddess,
so.
1937?
Nine. What Charlie's talking about, there was a Goodwin Grell has a bowl that was carved out of driftwood. It was a piece of wood that Elwood had found on the beach, and he carved this stylized kind of Art Deco nude female, and carrying a bowl in one hand and casting circular objects kind of back over her shoulder, and she was running. And when you turned it over, it said, "This is a dune goddess scattering bubbles of illusion to entertain and instruct children like us."
Yeah.
1939.
Oh, man, that was something.
So, you know, Charlie, you said that, you know, he would always laugh a lot, and he did. And he was always quick to remind me that this world is really just an illusion and not to take it too seriously. And he would catch me with that one all the time, because I would think my little frantic comings and goings were of utmost importance, you know, and he'd always kind of settle me down and say, you know, don't take it serious. This world is just an illusion.
He was dealing with the other world at the end of his life. I think he was very happy there, but there was something that he wasn't about to let go, even though he was failing mentally in some aspects. There was still the core of the creative artist that was driving him. I mean, he would like disappear for days and show up in Seattle, and it seemed like every time they would turn around, put him on a bus, and he would come back, I would be the first person that he would see, and I would end up listening to him tell me how fantastic it was at 82, 83 to sleep out in the ditch, and how exciting bus stations are again.
Well, you know, he came from a kind of a Hindu traditional background, in that he embraced Hindu theology early in his life. And with the Hindus, they have these different stages of life that they go through. You know, you're born and you're a child, and you go to school, and then as you approach maturity, you get married and you have children, and then you embark on your career part of your life, professional career. And then after that, and it's roughly translated as being about the time your children have children, then you give this all up and you become a sannyasin. And a sannyasin is a person who has renounced the world and goes and lives in the forest. And that's what he was doing at the end. And he did that to me too. I would see him and his beard would be have grass sticking in it where he had slept under a bridge someplace. And he would just smile, and he knew that I knew that's what he was doing. And what I think part of it was too is, you know, we're composed of a body, mind, and spirit. And his spirit had left, and his mind had left. And for some reason, his body was here, maybe to be the person that still is carving the wood and painting, throwing paint on canvas and jotting down wild thoughts. I don't know, but I had the feeling at the end that his spirit and his mind had left, and the body was still there. He would look right through me, and oftentimes didn't know who I was, and to him it didn't matter at that point.
I had a profound experience with Elwood one time when I was up at the top of the hill where Gudrun Grell lives, and at that particular time Frank Noyes from Ojai was visiting, and also the head of the Krishnamurti school in India was visiting, and I was sitting out with Elwood. And it was a dynamic day. I swear there were four different weather patterns happening at the same time. And up there, you could be high enough that it could be raining, a cloud could be passing, and it could be completely dry in another quarter of that courtyard that she lives in. That particular day, the air was charged with electricity. You could just feel it. And I sat down next to Elwood. I came up the other path, not from up Tierra Nueva, but from over near Elm Street, that approach. And I sat down with Elwood, and he had a knife, and he was slicing this apple incredibly thin and eating it very slowly. And somehow his mind was in the 1920s. Everything that he was saying to me was about the heyday of San Francisco and how one person had, I forget the name, and I don't think it was the real name because it changed, but generally bringing all of the arts together in some kind of unison was what he was throwing back out to me. And I listened to this almost like it was some kind of instruction, like it might have something I should know inside of it. Like I say, the air was charged. And then these folks, Gudrun and the head of the Krishnamurti school and Frank, came out, and we all kind of walked over, and at that point a cloud went down the middle of the thing, and half of us got wet and half of us didn't, and we were just sort of stunned. We all broke up. They took off, and Elwood and I went back, and he continued to slice the apple, and then he projected himself to a completely different time space, and I didn't know where he was at that point, so I just decided that the event was over, and I went down the hill and thought, I'm going to absorb that for a long time.
You know, sometimes it was pretty hard to get where he was. I remember one time, I had a lot of things going in my life, and was struggling with a lot of issues, personal issues, and I hadn't said anything to him about it. And I went to see him, and we were talking away, and he kind of interrupted me and looked at me, and he said, "You know something?" He says, "You need to understand that you're not going to be able to do it all in one lifetime," right out of nowhere. Just really caught me off guard. And he was right on. And he would do things like that. Rudy Gerber, Dr. Gerber, told me one time a story where he had been down to see Elwood and when he lived in the dunes. And they were walking back. Elwood had decided he was going to walk back to Oceana with him, and it's about a 2.5 mile hike from down there to get back to the creek. And Rudy said they'd be walking along talking, and all of a sudden Elwood wouldn't be there, and he would look back and Elwood would be on his knees pronouncing to the ocean, praising God. And he would just do that. He'd do that 2 or 3 times. Unannounced, he would just suddenly, Rudy would be alone. So he would be, you know, existing sometimes, I felt, simultaneously in several different places at the same time.
I remember that he had impressed Man Ray, and that there was I don't want to say what the quote was, but to the effect that perhaps Elwood had a better understanding of the abstract than even Man Ray felt he had, because of Elwood's understanding of color and its effects. Does that ring any bells to you?
They were contemporaries. You know, there was, at that time, the photographic work they were doing was called photograms, because they didn't have any word for it. And they were contemporaries, and they both started doing this about the same time. Man Ray gets pretty much the credit for having invented the technique, if you will, but the timeline is really blurred that far back. We're looking about 1946. And so I'm not really sure. I know they did exhibit together one time that I know of. So they were, you know, in the same league, so to speak.
And yeah, that's an aspect that a lot of people don't even recognize of Elwood, that he was so strong in photography. And we brought out his the film that he did here at the Excellence Center, had it reduced down to the Super 8 film so that we could actually show it in a film mode. And I think that is very important, not just seeing it on video. He was working with some really powerful elements, and I didn't understand it at first, the light modulators. And you gave me the pile of stuff, and then I figured out how he was doing that and how that was hooked up to sound and the effects on the body, on the physical body. And this was a silent film, however, but Elwood also experimented with his Sony tape recorder with, I think, the ultimate art to many people, and that's sound. And I think he was doing the same thing with the abstract. When you watched his film here bounce off the mirrors that we had here, you were opened up to many different timing signatures. And he knew something about that, even though it was a primitive time and primitive equipment. His little light modulator that he had hooked up to probably a speaker or something like that could turn almost any static object into a reflection of something that your body could interpret from a DNA point of view, not a conscious point of view.
That's what he was striving for in his art. I kind of got left behind where he was going when he went from being a purely representational artist to being abstract. But he was trying to do that very thing where he can invoke intuitively in the person who's looking at the art the response without visual clues. And this is, you know, as you put it, maybe the DNA of the soul or something of that sort. And I'm kind of a little bit of a nuts and bolts kind of person, so that was difficult for me to see where he was going with that. But I knew that's what he was trying to do. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the spin that you put on his work when he had the show here during the Dune Spirit Festival is, of course, you know, you had some music. Daryl Johnson?
Daryl Johnson,
fella,
yeah.
And Daryl Johnson with the music, and you did some dubbing effects.
We pre-produced some things.
That was good, but what I really liked was the tape that came out of that where the camera was videoing the audience watching the movie. And so...
It's up here on the wall, too.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh, there you
go.
This
some
is
of the pictures we printed out.
Talking about the stuff that's on the walls in this place. And what you got was the back of people's heads with the immediate foreground dark. So you had these heads, and the hair on people's head would be lightly frosted from the reflection off the screen, which was quite an effect. And then the movie itself with the sound. And so the secondary version that was, you know, the taping of the movie, you really got some a really nice spin on Elwood's work, and I think he would have loved it if he could see that.
This place, I think, really was because of Elwood. It's certainly what sent me this way. With I had another one of those profound experiences out there in the fields where he was hit by the train, and that's why we started it. There's no doubt about it. There was nobody more influential than Elwood on me as far as the arts are concerned and bringing all that together. And he must have been there that night. The place was packed, and it was packed, and me and Daryl were still setting things up and weren't sure even what was going to work. If you remember, there were no chairs set up when everybody showed up for the moment of the performance, and there were step ladders all over the place here. But the night itself and the way we recorded that, and dealing with film is not something that you... do on a regular basis too. So we had volunteers doing that. At the same time, we had video playing, which was a digital interpretation of Elwood's larger film, and then many reflections of it through mirrors that were on the wall here. It was just a fantastically overcharged night, and we were taking this and broadcasting it live over the air, and then capturing the signal after it was broadcast and piping it back in. So the whole place was a vibrant expression of what was going on the walls, all of the walls. we were in a gamelan fashion interpreting it. That brings us right up to Henry Cowell, who grew up in this area from about, I guess, age 14 on, and is considered the father of 20th century classical music, and the first one to incorporate world musics in as equal classics into the timing of his music and what became, well, today you're seeing it in every realm of music. Back in those days, there was no thought of paying attention to gamelan as a well-measured thing. And indeed, it's well-measured.
Well, he was definitely a pioneer. And the people that came after him, John Cage, and one of his students, Lou Harrison, who was here for the Dune Spirit Festival, and we had a chance to meet Lou Harrison and to listen to some of his compositions, and at the same time found some people who could play Henry Cowell's music. Not everybody can play that kind of music, where you know you're not using your fingers, you're using your forearms on the black keys to make these crashing dissonant sounds of the ocean and such things, and to do it right. It's not haphazard. This is all music that's on score. And so they found people, a fellow named Chris Brown up in the Bay Area, who could actually play this music, and he was here in Halcyon and played this stuff. And it's kind of a magical time, really, because Henry Cowell did spend time in Halcyon. He was a friend of the Varians. Him and John had known each other since the Varians lived in Palo Alto. And to hear his music being played there in Halcyon was a real exciting thing. And again, you know, we did have, you know, Lou Harrison, which was the student of Henry Cowell's student, John Cage. And John Cage spent some time in the dunes. There's in a magazine that was produced in the dunes, the Dune Forum, talks about him, you know, being there at Moy Mel, the colony in the dunes. And so that whole movement in music is tied right here to the Central Coast, right here in the South County.
So a lot of the ambient beat music that comes out of Europe and out of rap music today, that's using the ethnic musics as part of its fabric, ultimately started right here.
The thing that interests me about Henry Cowell's music is he plays with dissonance, because some of that music, you won't like it the first time you hear it. It's not a diatonic scale where everything is in fifths, thirds, and sevenths and sounds harmonious. Parts of it are, of course, but other parts are almost painful. And he builds this kind of painful platform. And then in music, it's a thing they call conflict resolution. And they do it quite a bit in jazz, where they'll get right to the ragged edge of dissonance and they'll break, make a nice, clean, smooth break, and it starts flowing again. And you feel that conflict resolution. You feel good inside. And the music, therefore, can jerk you around quite a bit. You know, it'll take you to places where you're a little bit uncomfortable, and then, bam, you feel really good. So I don't know. Were you going to play some music?
Was it number 14 on here, did you say?
Yeah, that's
you're
that's,
sure?
That's,
I've got
I really
that,
like that piece.
Hooked
yeah.
up, and I'm, geez, my eyes, but this is hard to see. Is that 18 minutes long?
No, that's just a.
Or
it's
eight
not
18. Long.
It's a. Yeah, it's just a small piece.
I
don't think it's even that long. It's a thing done with porcelain bowls and tin pans and Well, you'll just have to hear it.
Yeah. That'll give us a little chance to stretch our legs here. You're listening to Excellent Radio, and we've got quite a bit more time ahead of us and a lot more things to talk about here. Stick around. But for right now, let's listen to some of the music of Henry Cowell as performed by the Abel Steinberg Winant Trio from a CD entitled Set of Five. And anything else you want to say about this CD? It's available.
I would just like people to hear it. I particularly like this one piece here. It takes you a lot of different places.
Okay. Yeah, all right. We got the mics back on again, and I could cue up this other piece while you're perhaps talking about this one we're about to put in here. We're going to the Smithsonian. Hold on one sec. I bet that's on. We're going to the Smithsonian collection of Henry Cowell's music, and you actually get to hear his voice on some of these. Let's see if I can find a pair of glasses. I could be in the here now. Right now. Alright, what's the number on that one? Did you see?
Yeah, it's number one.
Number one, that's for sure.
The very first one.
Alright. Do you want to describe this piece?
Sure. This next piece coming up here is The Tides of Mananan by Henry Cowell. And Mananan is a god of the sea in Gaelic folklore. And what Henry did in this piece was he tried to get beyond the normal range of the piano, and the bass notes he played with his elbows. And so it's all the black keys to make this crashing sound. And when you first hear it, if it's the first time you've heard it, you won't like it. But as you listen to it, I think you will. And to see the score of this particular piece actually written down looks pretty strange. You don't have the normal bar staffs with little notes in there. It's lines, big heavy lines showing just how far. Not many people can do this, what he's doing, because of the range. But again, the fellow Chris Brown, who can play this music, did play it for us in Halcyon on a big grand piano, and it was pretty interesting. So I hope you like it.
And I wanted to say, too, like you said, you may not like it at first, but this was really far-reaching and dangerous stuff to do in the world of music when Henry Cowell was happening. He got beat up for this kind of stuff. You know, people got really mad about this kind of music, and they had a certain set way that they thought music should be, and Henry just dashed all of that. Let's go ahead and listen to this piece, and we'll be right back with you. You're listening to Excellent Radio. This is Henry Cowell's music. Not your normal Barney song.
No, it's not a Irish jig, that's for sure.
Pick another piece off of here.
There's an interesting one called The Banshee.
Oh boy, that one's eerie.
Yes, and what he's doing there, he actually plays the piano inside. He has to take the lid off the piano so he can scratch the strings with a, it's like a guitar pick or something. But he's not just randomly scratching. He has to scratch certain strings to resonate with the chords that he's playing outside the piano with the other hand.
This was quite a sight to see. Chris Brown was working this.
This was happening in Halcyon, and we got to watch this. And it's going beyond what most people do with a piano. And you have to have a pretty broad reach, for one thing, to do that. One of the difficulties associated with playing this music is there was heretofore no way of writing the score for this, dragging the strings on the inside of the piano. Again, it has to be certain strings in certain sequences dragged at a certain rate of speed. And so what you get is this song called The Banshee, and it is rather eerie.
You better tell us what about the Banshee, though, and what these are connected to, the Irish myths.
You know, Henry describes that in this disc, but it's a family ghost is what it is, and I don't remember which part of the family the ghost is from, but it is a family ghost, and that's kind of all I remember about it. But you'll hear this wailing and this screeching and this playing the inside and the outside of the piano, which was, like Charlie says, the first few times he did that in a concert hall, some people got up and walked out.
And those are the pleasant ones. Okay, let's listen to the Banshee.
The Banshee.
I remember the first time I got a hold of the CD and went home and played that real loud.
Well, it's pretty interesting to see somebody actually playing that with one hand inside the piano and the other one on the outside. Because you have to, and working the foot pedals too, because those strings that he's dragging, if he wants to hit two of them but not the one in the middle, he drags all three and he mutes the one in the middle with the foot pedal. So he's got one hand inside, one hand on the outside, because there are musical notes in there, and at the same time he's working his feet to mute the strings that he's dragging inside the piano. It's quite a thing to see, really.
And that it happens in real time, too. It's easy enough to do this 20th century classical music with multi-tracks. Yeah. But when you feel the spirit and you throw yourself on top of your piano...
One person on stage, no mixing.
Yeah, yeah. Really groundbreaking. He was sponsored, he had a patron, Charles Ives.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's mm-hmm. right.
Who also worked in this kind of medium, but not near as abstract as Henry Cowell. And strangely enough, Charles Ives, his music really wasn't celebrated that much until he was gone. He made his millions in the insurance industry.
And, I didn't know that.
Basically helped Henry Cowell through darker periods when he needed financial and moral support. Charles Ives was ultimately his backer.
There's some interesting things that came out of this musical event in Halcyon, and one of them was that there was some boxes found, and I think it was in the old Varian home, of some of Henry Cowell's original notations, and it turns out that there had been stuff found previously to that that had been sent to the Library of Congress back in Washington, D.C. So Andy Harp, who was one of the key movers and shakers in getting this whole event together, was in the last I knew in the process of reaccessing copies of the Halcyon information. And with the hope that perhaps there was some unpublished pieces in those boxes that were maybe even written in Halcyon. So there may be something yet forthcoming there.
Well, Andy's back in New York at this time and maybe a little bit closer to actually getting his hands on something back there.
You know, he shared with me that he was going to go back there in... And that was definitely one of the deciding factors, is to be closer to what's going on.
Okay, I'm just throwing another tape in here so you can take this home and hear it. Yeah, I found one of the earliest, I can't remember if it was 33. It might have been the earliest of 33s, but it was on really solid platters. You remember the Henry Cowell collection that I found?
You showed that. It's another one of those things that you unearthed in one of these out-of-the-way places.
Yeah, there it was. And that was my introduction to 20th century classical music, besides John Cage, which... members of the team, when we were on KCBX, we did something called Radio Free Obispo. So Bill Pask, who lives in Morro Bay, often brought reflections of John Cage, introduced me to 20th century classical that way. But I had never bought any of that stuff. I liked what it sounded like, but it was that record, that old hard record of Henry Cowell's that kind of flipped me out and really opened me up personally.
You wonder where all that stuff goes, you know. There's so much stuff out there on those old 33s, and even before that they had the old lacquer rolls and music and stuff.
I have a wire recorder here.
There you go. There's so much.
You wouldn't believe it. Somebody showed me one of those Hallmark cards where you pull your, squeeze your finger on a piece of string and this song comes out of it. Well, here it is right underneath us, an old wire recorder, one thin piece of wire that has a radio program of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys here in this unit that I have right back here. Just a strand of wire. So for those who are doubters that there might be spirits and power beyond what you normally see, there's some pretty sound evidence that big things come in small packages.
Well, there you have it, music and a piece of wire.
Yeah.
Drag your thumbnail across it. And,
so, yeah, Cal had something going on, huh?
So, yeah, yeah.
Got another piece we could play?
Well,
any thoughts? I mean, I love the whole thing. I love just letting this play at home.
Actually, on this one you just played, there's one. In fact, it's the second one after that you just played here. It's Exaltation. It's a little less abstract, kind of a lilting, happy thing. Mm-hmm. And probably a little more to the taste of your listeners here.
Well, that's the one I opened up with when we first came in, because I felt the same way. It was a nice, gentle way of being introduced to gamelan music.
Good point.
Thank you.
So the next time your daughter or son is banging on the piano, leave them alone. What's that? They said, it's in them. It's got to come out.
I'd be curious to see what the response is of some of the people that are out there listening to this, Charlie.
Yeah, stuff that don't get played very often, unfortunately. I know the station down at KCSB 91.9 has some of these kind of things happening early morning, one of the days of the week. And I tune in, and I'm very surprised, and I get pretty excited. I think, oh, I had to record that and rebroadcast it, but I always get caught in the middle of it. There's just not that much time being set aside for the influences of Henry Cowell's compositions on people like John Cage. Now, some people have made John Cage study their program for some 20 years on some radio stations, and that's a rare thing.
Well, you know, he did some things that were, he took off in many ways where Henry Cowell, you know, left off, and he was Henry's student and was very much influenced by him, and he did some compositions called Landscapes. And I've only read about these things. I've never heard them. And he does something similar to what I know you do, playing with blending of sounds and mixing sounds, only he would take radios and tune them arbitrarily to different stations and then modulate them in a way to create rhythms, tones, overtones, and then superimpose music on top of this. I haven't heard any of this stuff, but I know that's, you know, what John Cage was about. He was very, very... experimental.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. Should we keep on playing some of Henry Cowell's pieces, or should we turn discussion to... I mean, there's so many things we could talk about in regards to the Dunites and the people that were out there.
Well, I'm up for a little music myself.
Okay. I saw that one piece, number 16... which, as I go through, you should really, if you're interested in any of this stuff by Henry Cowell, this really is an excellent CD with a very informative booklet that goes along with it. Just the booklet itself, I think, is worth half the price. And on this number 16, The Voice of Lear, which was L-I-R, 1919, Henry Cowell uses both diatonic and chromatic melodies and clusters. At times, a full octave of chromatic tones is played, and then all are released except the outside tones of the octave itself, giving a special... Boy, I can't even pronounce the musical description there. You want to? You wouldn't try that, would you?
I'm not looking at it here, so I'll...
S-F-O-R-Z-A-N-D-O. Giving a special, well, a special sound. And then the last line of it says, the composer made an Aeolian piano roll of this piece in the mid-1920s. So I thought, let's give that one a try, and I'll give you a chance to pick one here, Norm. Okay?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you. Whoa, the roar. We were just talking about the underlying ocean roar in that piano. And an experience I had. But now we're going to move on to another tune that I can hardly call them tunes. They're not tunes.
Pieces. Compositions?
Compositions, okay. This is 1914. It's called The Anger Dance. And we're both trying to guess as to whether or not Henry Cowell narrates this piece. And so we're kind of torn between whether we should read the liner note about his visit to the doctor.
I think we should just play it. But it's been a while since I've heard this one, but I think he narrates it. And he's very angry about what transpired between him and the doctor, who unnecessarily wanted to cut off his leg. But listener, be warned, this piece is entitled Anger, and it's very dissonant. And he pounds on this piano trying to get the anger out in a cathartic sort of way. And, you know, after each concert, these pianos, and they were top-line grand pianos, had to be retuned because this is hard on a piano, and it may be a little hard on a listener's ears, but you know, once in a while you have to bite into a slice of raw lemon just to see what it's like, and it doesn't last long, but tune in and see what you think about this one.
This is called Anger. Now let's make sure we get the right one on that. We don't want to play something and make anybody angry. Unjustly. As we said, that was called Anger, and it was Henry Cowell interpreting his response to that stupid doctor who wanted to chop off his leg without getting other consultation, let's say. And on the way home, I guess that piece just roared through him, and you can kind of see a silent film and somebody on the old piano roll making necessary emphasis, every little bump-a-dum, bump-a-dum.
That's the feeling I get, and it's the very thing he was trying to do, get it out there and express it, which is usually the best way.
I can kind of see him picking up the crutch, swinging it around his head and hitting something as he's walking down the street in defiance. And I guess he made it because he died with two legs.
That's true.
And he needed them all just to play his music. Yeah, that's also true. And it really was an experience. I'm really thankful that everybody who got involved in the Dune Spirit Festival brought that out. It was something we weren't aware of, Henry Cowell's music and, you know, the connection that he had to this land and I think the greater spirit world.
Well, you know, there was something to be said for a live performance. Some of this is difficult to visualize when you hear it, you know, but if you can see somebody doing these strange things with an instrument, like the first piece you played, the very trio where they're using pots and pans and some ceramic bowls, and these things are tuned. They're not just random pieces of things you find in your kitchen. They're all tuned, and even though it sounds dissonant, there's a reason for it. So, and when you see it again, when you see it live, it's just really adds a dimension that you really can't get by listening to it.
Yeah, that's really true. Well, I'd like to just play the whole darn thing, but I'm not sure that's the best way to approach what time we have left. Is some other things we'd like to kind of float across before you want to make a turn in any particular direction? And there's many turns. We haven't even opened up the chronology of the due nights.
Well, you know, there's so much stuff, you know, going on. You know, I get on the internet and find there's people I know, you know, who are doing things. I don't know. You remember Richard McConaughey came in here one day and
we did a show here, a talk show. He and Lawrence Blakesley came in and we talked about the use of art as a catharsis. And he was doing the exhibit at his place in Morro Bay of the O.J. Simpson with his child that was blown up that caused the stir in the area.
Yeah, I forgot he did a show here. I ran into him here one day, and he came in to see you, I guess, in conjunction with putting together that show. And I've known Dick since I worked on the fire department. He was he spent some time working in the fire department, too. But he does this little thing he calls a daily muse, and he just takes newspapers from around the world and leaves the headline there and leaves the print there and just makes a painting right in the middle of it depicting his impression of what he's just read. And it's pretty interesting stuff, and I get on the internet, and there his stuff is, and from all around the world, these paintings and stuff, and it adds a dimension to his art, I mean, because there's the printed headlines. It's a real event. And he's just putting his impressions down in color and through his art. And there's stuff like that going on that, you know, you don't realize. People are looking behind things and around corners and under things, trying to find a new way to express things and to see, you know, into things. And so it just kind of goes on and on and on.
Carl Kempton's works in the 3D, the visuals, the deconstruction of language and letters. Incredible stuff. Certainly can't be described adequately over 14 watts when you're talking about the multi-dimensions that Carl works in. And he also was a longtime caretaker of Elwood Decker, and certainly understood and was open to what Elwood was saying as far as his Hindu understandings. Carl lives here on the land that Gavin Arthur owned, which is now owned by Gudrun Grell. And between him and his wife, who is considered the wheatgrass lady, there are two fine sciences right here in the middle of the five cities that many know about, but many don't know about.
He had a long-standing exhibit down here, the Cauldron Wall, and he featured a lot of his own work, but also a lot of work of other visual poets, where they try to add a visual dimension to the written word. by using a lot of different techniques. I know that Carl, for years and years, he hammered on a typewriter and made patterns out of words, and he called them typoglyphs. And I don't know if he was the first one to ever do that, but he's people know who he is. It's his approach. That's his path. And so he's another voice here on the Central Coast. A lot of people don't understand it, don't want to understand it, but year after year he keeps putting that stuff out there. And there's a website now of visual poets, and he's one of the voices that has collectively gotten together and put together this site. And they feature, you know, visual poets from all over the world.
It's nice that that has finally taken. As you said, we had the Cauldron Wall here, and it really wasn't until he went to India for a good many months that we weren't able to keep up with it. But it was also at the point where opportunities were changing. He did a journal, which was a collection of the visual poetry, as you said. But at the same time, he was one of the main firekeepers of what was called mail art. And that's M-A-I-L. And anything that actually went through the mail to an exhibit would have to be posted, which ultimately meant that it was an equal playing field. Just because it was art didn't mean that it had to go through a broker or all these other hoops, and that's what they were trying to free up and to create a brotherhood of artists without boundaries. So much of that stuff was exhibited for many, many years, and most of those shows ultimately would turn into a journal, or it would be represented in some kind of way, and everything would be exhibited. And at about the time that stopped, the world of websites was starting to take, and now it'll last forever. It won't just be when you can find a wall to put something up.
Yes, you'll be able to store a person's life work on a postage stamp, and therefore you could store a lot of things. I was just thinking here, listening to you talk about that, that right where you're sitting, if we would go back a few years, that's where the Cauldron Wall was. It was kind of a U-shaped little cubicle that you kind of set out there for him to put up as exhibits and stuff, and you'd be completely encircled with that now. But, you know, the one thing I'll say that I like about this place here, where the hole in the sky, is that it's changing and evolving all the time. And now I see out there you've got people working live theater. You've got some seats set up there and some lighting and some stage backdrop stuff. And this place just keeps on going.
Yeah, and Stolen Fire Productions, which put these on, are people that I've known for close to 20 years. They were the family that became my son's first babysitter, and they had everything to do with the early days of the Pismo Light Opera. So my son would, as part of the babysitting troupe, would go to many of those plays and watch that whole family do their magic, and many of the kids in that family have grown up to go on to serious acting careers. And we had a space, and Dwayne asked if we might take that opportunity and do something good with it, and boy, we couldn't be prouder. They've taken manuscripts from around the world, literally, with no consideration for financial gain, with the belief, like we had, that given the space, there could be multitudes, unlimited numbers of great writers performing and having their works performed, if given the opportunity, and that these things could work, and if they didn't have to jump through the hoops, that the message would more clearly shine through them.
Well, you know, a starving artist is a term they've used for a lot of years for people who, you know, are trying to be musicians, artists, writers. anything along that line, and it's because of the hoops, as you call it, you know, that you know that's you have to be able to directly translate your efforts into dollars and cents, or you're going to start missing a few meals, and that alone will deter a lot of people. So what's happening here is that that's no longer a requisite. People can come down here and put art on the walls, you know, if you they can talk to you, and maybe they got a show or something they want to put on. If people put on a concert, you've had that, you've had everything I can think of in this place, and it's people that just want to be able to express their version of truth. And so, you know, I've always felt good that you've been able to put this place together and make it go. You know what? It's quit raining out there.
We got lucky.
And I rang. I don't know if you saw me out there wringing my socks out.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, getting across the river. And I
yeah, we got a pool.
Kind of misjudged it and got both feet wet, so I wrung both socks out and are just about dry.
Oh, you should have said I could have put and, this fan on there. We would have had you all fixed up.
Well, that's no big deal. But actually, I haven't had any supper yet, so I'm thinking I might get out there before the rain starts again. And,
okay.
The river's gone down. And
why don't I let a pile of Henry Cowell music play through? Maybe I will go back to the portion of the Abel Steinberg Winant Trio and play the Henry Cowell music that they performed on that. What do you think of that?
That'll
give you something to listen to as you motivate down the highway with half-dry socks.
I can listen to it on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, I'm out of here, and thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you, Norm. And, well, we'll come back again, and we'll focus on what's happening at that time. And I'm sure that'll be fun. We're going to have to do another slideshow, too, of some of the Art of the Dunites and maybe the history. I think that's long overdue again.
It's been a while, so give me a jingle.
We're going to do it.
I'm out of here.
We've been listening to Norm Hammond, who wrote the book on the Dunites that you can get at Hole in the Sky. And can they still get that through the South County Historical Society? Yeah. And probably at Books West, I would expect. So is there an actual title to that besides the Dunites? Do you remember?
That's it, just the Dunites.
Ask for it. There's a little map in there. You'll find out about some of the people that lived here in our dunes and what they did afterwards. And I guess you've got another book coming. We've got our fingers crossed. It'll be more about Elwood than the rest of the Dunites. Is that true?
That's true.
All right. I'm glad to hear that. Well, let's see if I can cue this up. This is called Set of Five by Henry Cowell. By the Abel Winant Steinberg Trio, who came and played this and performed this in front of an audience here in Halcyon. I guess that's about 2 years ago now. Might even be more. Boy, good golly. All right, here we go. Let's see.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
there you heard the Abel Winant Steinberg Trio were performing A Set of Five by Henry Cowell, who grew up in this area, was the father of 20th century classical music. And I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed our little get-together here. Norm Hammond, who has participated in many different aspects of life here on the Central Coast and is certainly one of the key people in keeping the history of the people and this coast alive, and the truth of that alive. Well, hold your socks. We're about to make a sudden change of direction, but then again, maybe not. If you were to follow our show and you heard the sound of the banshee that we played by Henry Cowell, well, discordance is something you're already used to, so stick around. Don't forget that coming up on January 22nd, we're going to be doing a live simulcast with the library, and we will be doing a live simulcast with Treasure Ivan, who has been developing a Children's of All Ages show and CD here on Excellent Radio over the last couple of weeks. So you are invited to participate. You can either go up to the South County Library at 7 o'clock or stay right there at home and dial in 88.9 and listen to a phenomenal talent, Treasure Ivan, Ivan Oles, who has been performing in the libraries and schools in this area. But prior to that, he knocked off just about everyone in New York City and has rave reviews from the library system there. And everybody loves Ivan's music, young and old. That'll happen on the 22nd. You mark that on your calendar. And also, keep an eye on what's going on here at Excellent Radio. A lot of changes happening, and looks like we're aiming at getting it all into one big ball of wax and coming out with a new schedule so you know what's going on here. But at this time, it's time to prepare yourself for the Frankly Frank show. With that, I'll just turn it all over to you.
Okay. What you got now is little Fu Manchu with Action Is Go.